All right, this is for real, just like we're going live. Hello, welcome to Art House Radio. This is episode number 33. Just trying to give myself a little pep talk there. Hope you don't mind. How are you? I'm great. Had a bit of a rough day yesterday and some bike trouble, but you know what? It resulted in a beautiful new Huffy Cruiser, orange and black, that I'm calling the Flight of the Netherlands. So I'll put some pictures up on Instagram, at TroystonD. And on Twitter, at Spanish Peanuts, and on Facebook, .com/arthouse43. So check it out. Tell me what you think of the new wheels. They're so far so good. Smooth, running like a top. Today's episode. And by the way, there are maybe, this will probably be the second to last episode, maybe third to last of season one. I'm going to stick to that earlier idea of creating seasons, give myself a little break. I'll continue to number them, the same. I'm not going to start over with the numbering, but the season two, give me some time to think about what I might want to do and, take it from there. But like this episode and probably just one other one, which I will unveil a project idea that I have called Project 100. I think you'll like it. I'll also play a work that I haven't played on the air before. It was premiered in Portland last fall for two xylophones. Some people were there, and the recording's really good, and I'll play that for the Project 100 episode, the grand finale of Season 1 of Art House Radio. Tune in for the grand finale. Today I'm talking with Santos Ramos. We were talking about a book he read called Alone Together. I can't remember the name of the author. It sort of came up in the conversation. So it wasn't like we prepared it and I just am drawing a total blank, but it was about how the devices that we're creating, how we're sort of part of, like we all work for Apple basically, or Microsoft, because we're helping to develop these projects. We all work for whichever apps that are coming out. We're helping to shape them, to make them better, et cetera. And how is that affecting us? We just sort of went off, the two of us, most of it probably half negative, half positive. I don't know. We'll see what you think. We've had the discussion before, but I think you're going to really like this one because it brought up some new ideas, I think, some interesting food, brain food to sort of nosh on a bit, if you will. Remember, you can follow us on Instagram at TroystonD, at Spanish Peanuts on Twitter, and facebook.com/arthouse43. You can also visit the website, arthouse43.com, click on donate and make a contribution. In that final episode of the season, which will probably be next week, I'll unveil Project 100, and I will also be talking about the project idea has a lot to do with composers or artists making a living. And so I'm going to read a few excerpts, a good chunk of the article that David Byrne wrote on how sound creators or musicians or composers or whatever you want to call them, you could say artists in general, how are they going to make a living in the era of the internet or the streaming era? It's a really interesting article, and it has a lot to do with the project that I'm going to shove down your throats, so to speak, next episode. So look for that. And there might be another episode, but that'll probably be the final one. So let's not dally any further, shall we? Let's go straight into the episode, my conversation with Santos Ramos. Enjoy. We're talking about past episodes of Art House Radio, and particularly a couple of the episodes have had more downloads than others. Specifically, the Terrence McKenna episode that Santos and I did back in the third week of this 30-week campaign, or 30-episode campaign, I should say. It's been longer than 30 weeks. But and then we started talking about, sometimes it's difficult if you don't have a theme to come up with things to talk about. But then we started thinking, well, there's always technology. And he mentioned this book. What was it called?
It's called A Prehistory of the Cloud. Sort of like a critical analysis of like how clouds function, how the internet works, how subjectivity is formed through these kind of modern technologies. So like we don't see how they're working a lot because so much of it is wireless. And even the idea of a cloud is very like abstract and like out of view, out of like anything that's readily viewable. So we think that we see everything that's going on, but we don't. A lot of it is just hidden. And I used to have a teacher who would say that systems of power are successful to the extent that they're able to hide themselves. So within that context, like, what are these technologies being created for? And then what is the impact of them being hidden? So if we live in an economy and a society that values profits first and everything is about making things more efficient and about getting people to buy things, that's what these technologies are usually geared towards. And that's what a lot of inventions are geared towards. There's nothing about, there's nothing inherent about a computer that says a computer has to look that way, right? We think of it like computers look like laptops or phones or whatever, but they're shaped and function the way that they are shaped and function because somebody invented them because they thought people would buy them that way and because it's meant to increase efficiency. And so these are the values that have driven the way that these things look and the way that they run. So imagine if we lived in a totally different society that had totally different values. What kind of inventions would be made? What would a computer look like if computers existed at all? So the book is, I was just kind of riffing there at the end. Like, it doesn't necessarily talk about those things, but that's some thoughts that it sort of provoked in reading that, like all of the hidden sort of elements of modern technologies like that.
The hidden elements as in like the secret motivations?
Both, like the literal, like we can't even see the way that things are networked because of the wireless aspect. But also, yeah, like the hidden sort of motivations, the way that we're networked in terms of like economy and value systems as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. It is always geared, it seems, towards participating in the structure of the flow of money. And those things can be corrupted and used for different sorts of things, government control, spying, you know, being able to monitor what people watch for political reasons. And once that happens, once that sort of gets out, there's no squeezing that toothpaste back in the tube if people are going to continue to use these devices.
Yeah, and the interesting part to me along those lines in the book was, which I already sort of mentioned, is the way that our subjectivity is shaped by them too. So like the way we think of ourselves, the way it...
Oh,
you can
look. Oh, I was just picking up.
Oh. So I think the way that the book really only starts to point towards this direction, and then like other books are more useful in this way, but it's talking about a neoliberal sort of subjectivity. So these technologies really essentially reinforce individualism, like extreme individualism. If you think about technologies that came before, even if we think of televisions were less individual. In the beginning, of course, like now they're sort of merging, right? Like computers and televisions. But, you know, the criticism of TVs were that, you know, it's just pumping information into your brain and you have no sort of control over that information that's being fed to you as a consumer. And now computers are being plugged as these liberatory devices because you do have that control. Yet in another way, they're way more individualistic because everything's personal. Whereas with TVs, at least you're sitting around and watching them together. Not that you can't do that with computers, but it's more personalized, I think. I think I told this story in an earlier podcast, but there was, in the house where we grew up, there was a dining room next to the living room, and in the living room there was a TV, of course, and then the dining room there was, we shared one computer, one desktop computer. And I was in middle school, always over there for hours a day, just IMing with my friends, while my family was in the room next to me, watching TV together, laughing and talking, whatever, just watching shows together. And Troy would always yell into me that I was antisocial or just like talking shit, like why are you always on the computer? And I'm like, it's interactive. Like, while I'm in the corner by myself.
Just typing, they don't understand me. They don't know what...
Yeah, but to me, that's... that sort of makes me rethink about, you know, how we're sold this narrative of how democratizing the internet is or social media is or computers are. Because in certain ways, like, other technologies that are deemed being less democratic, less interactive, are actually... They're more social. A TV is more social than, like, me being on my phone. Like, I can show you a video on my phone, but that's not how we use personalized machines, really.
That's true. I never thought about that. A film, going to a movie theater, that's social. Watching TV, it's social because it's you aren't able to interact with it for the most part. There might be some things. If you're using Apple TV or Roku, you're interacting with it by choosing what you watch or... sometimes there are movies, like I think in Portland, where they had like Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of things, where your tweets would show up on the screen or something like that. But that's very rare for the most part. Yeah, that's right. That it's, I never thought about TV being community because you're watching this thing together. Whereas on the phone, we're all on our own swimming like separately. Trying to make it to some sort of island, but really through the individual qualities of a phone, it's kind of circling back because we're all joining the same social networks. We're all joining the same, so it's like we're all sort of like a facade or there's a mask going on there. It is individual, yes, but we're all participating using the same types of phones, using the same programs, using the same apps. So it's kind of almost like we're joining the collective. We're certainly participating in building this machine, whatever it is. Like if you think of Apple having those factories with suicide nets outside of their factories so that people can't even kill themselves so that they can keep making these tablets and MacBooks, which I participate in. But in a sense of the design of it, we're all participating. We're all working in that factory because we're all approving or disapproving of certain apps or the new formats of Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So we're all working for these companies.
But again, like we were just talking about how things are invisible. We can't see the way that we're connected literally by disposing of wires and then how we create networks through value systems. In a similar way, as consumers, that's another invisible network that we don't see. Like we participate in that. But we have to note that we participate in that because it isn't like we're so disconnected that it's not that visible. And we have to remind ourselves of that. Like, actually, we do participate in that, not just with technology, but with all sort of products that we consume or purchase.
Yeah, it is an invisible connection, but it's like one of those things where you buy a device and you use it and you try to integrate it into your life like it's a shoe. But really, the device, I've said this before, but the device is probably taking something from you as well, because when you move towards something, you're pulling away from something else. So it's not just one thing that you get to pick up, use, and throw it away, and it doesn't affect you, or it's not getting anything from you. We don't know, especially when you have those invisible connections you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. There's this other book called, what is that woman's name? Terry Schirkel, something like that. She wrote a book called...
Sounds fake.
She wrote a book called Alone Together. So, okay. Which is an interesting title in the context of what we're talking about, because we're always after this... We're always going after this thing, this social dynamic, And so we're reaching out, we're taking ourselves out of our immediate context, our immediate physical surroundings, in pursuit of this larger abstract social network. But what she does, she looks at the way the relationship between children and like toy robots. So you can interpret that widely, like Furby, you know, these mechanical dolls, basically. And so she studies the way that, like, I can't remember if she focuses on like cognitive development or like emotional development, probably some of both. But then she, you know, compares that to like how we're sort of alone together. We have created this narrative about how we're so much more connected. But then again, in other ways, like you just said, like we're taking ourselves away from other contexts. You can't just always be expanding and be present everywhere without spreading yourself more thin. If you put in headphones or if you get out your phone and look at your phone, you're taking yourself something away from that immediate surrounding.
Alone together reminds me of it's just the paradox of being by yourself in a room, but connected to the entire world. So you're in sort of in solitary confinement and also connected to everything at the same time. But the interesting thing that you just said was that spreading ourselves too thin in the old days, or even today, when it comes to governments and militaries spreading themselves thin, the Roman Empire spread themselves too thin, collapse. People make that same parallel to Americans and all our bases around the world. What about the individual spreading themselves too thin? You've got yourself here. You've got your Facebook presence. You've got your Instagram presence. You have Twitter presence, your email, whatever it else, your website. Are we spreading ourselves too thin to be conquered by something that this invisible connection that we have, something that we can't foresee, some sort of barbarian invasion in like a psychological sense or in a technological sense that we don't know exactly how it's going to happen yet.
Yeah. So yeah, that's really interesting. So it's like, we're actually being consumed by, we're not just consuming these products, like the larger structure that's creating these products is also sort of consuming us in those ways.
Yeah. And we're, it's just like, I don't know if it's a metaphor or what, but spreading ourselves too thin with our thoughts and our minds, where we can't physically be in different places and spread ourselves too thin, but in our minds we can, because we're in different places. We're at home, but we're answering work emails, or we're at a movie and answering texts from other friends who are doing something else. Like, all of a sudden we're not in that place anymore. We're spreading ourselves out and we're making ourselves vulnerable to who knows what, mental disease or, you know, all kinds of physical ailments that come from the stress of that, or if we're just contributing to this singularity that's part of that invisible connection you're talking about.
And even just thinking about the societal sort of investment that we've made in information. So now I'm thinking about spreading ourselves too thin in terms of like, well, all we need to do is produce more and more information and data. All we need is to have access to all this information. Well, information is only, it only does so much on its own. Like, we can have access to all the information in the world. You can raise awareness about all the different causes in the world, but there's some other element about processing and how you process that information and what you do with it that I think we've invested in much less.
I wonder if there are people who teach tech courses either in high school or at universities or colleges who find it valuable to maybe have each student memorize a Shakespeare monologue or a relevant thing. Because when you're talking about, we have all these access to all this information, but we don't really know anything because we can look it up. So we don't have to remember anything. We don't have to memorize anything. So in some ways our brains are getting very good at figuring out apps and like connecting with people, but are we good at holding information and remembering quotes and remembering lines and stories? And maybe we're getting stronger in some sense in our ability to figure out these devices, but are we losing something that, you know, we take from something and we think we get, nothing's being lost, but we're pushing in one bit of information and maybe we're losing others, that ability to just remember experiences or to remember poetry or to be able to sing or to whatever. I mean, it's got to be possible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's, you know, necessarily all negative. I mean, it's definitely, I think it's, you know, irrefutable that it's changing the way we think, the way that we process information, just mentally. I think it's probably a balance. From like a teaching perspective, I've thought a lot about this because that's come across my mind too. Is like, well, I'm not even going to use email. I'm just going to tell them, you know, we're just going to go old school. But it's also, it's just a balance of like having to be critical of those things, but also being real about the world that we live in and like, how do we navigate this world that we live in critically? Because it's good to like sort of, it's not that you have to accept everything. You don't want to accept everything the way that it is, but we're all forced to engage the world in certain ways. So being able to navigate that while still being able to be critical, I think, is the balance that I try to go for in terms of teaching. But
it's probably a pretty good balance. I mean, you can't cut everything out. You've got to use it to a certain degree. You have to be online, but it makes it, wherever we're headed, even if all the aspects of technology aren't negative, wherever we're headed, we don't know what the balance going to look like in the future. It could become extremely negative if we're headed into a place that's going to be, you know, we're already kind of very addicted to these things. We don't process them very well. It's been a very short amount of time that we've had to integrate these into our lives. I don't think we've done a very good job of it. I think we're doing okay. We're smart and we're recognizing that it's happened. But what if we lose that ability to recognize that there's a problem?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah. And that's the tricky thing, is that the general sort of assumption is that you should accept it and that there's something wrong with you or you're a Luddite if you don't accept everything. So even in terms of pedagogy, like...
I like Lansing Luddites as a better name for their baseball team.
Change it from the Lugnuts to the Luddites, yeah. But yeah, so like everything revolves around computers. For the last 2 or 3 semesters, I've been teaching at Michigan State in a computer lab. And these computers are like bolted down to the ground, like in rows. It takes up pretty much the entire classroom. But it's kind of annoying because... In one sense, it's easy because I can say, get online, submit this thing, we're going to write about whatever. But what if I don't want to base our writing or whatever we're doing off of reading or watching something on the internet? What if I wanted to... one of my good friends has a background in theater and in improv. And so I've been learning little like theater games from him that intellectually meet some very similar goals to like reading an essay or whatever, but it's a different level of engagement. So to give one example, he has this theater game that you pretend the room that you're in is a map and everybody goes to where they're from on this map. And you give them a starting point, like this is Lansing or East Lansing. Everybody just go to where you think relative, where you're from is in this room. And it's a way to get to know each other. And then you say, okay, now go back, choose an ancestor, go back 500 years, try and guess where they were at on this map. And so you could replicate this on a computer and just say, you know, open up some sort of digital map and look at it and everybody like points to it or something like that. But is it really the same thing as like getting up and moving with your body? It's engaging in a different way, right? But if everything is geared towards the computer and we're literally bolting computers down 2 inches in front of our students' faces and like making it very difficult for them to learn in other ways, then that's when it becomes an issue, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if the generations now that are native, digital natives, that have always grown up with the internet and they grew up in a post 9/11 world, I don't know how they function socially. I always hear that from older generations that they have issues with higher percentages of social awkwardness or higher percentages of an insufficient amount of in-person conversations or telephone conversations. Phone conversations don't seem to happen with anybody anymore. Yeah, being in a room together pulls us back to that experience of being human. Whereas I think the sitting in front of a screen, especially a computer screen, it sort of pushes us towards cyborgism.
Yeah. And I mean, I was pretty young when the internet became popular. Like I think I was in elementary school when AOL chat rooms came out and that kind of shit. But the comfortable thing for me as a teacher is to say, just get on the computer and do this thing, you know? So even for me, it's like, that's sort of the default. So I have to like push myself to do something, to do more physical sort of activities. Not that they're strenuous, but like more just like learning with your body or like engaging people. Because that can be intellectual too. It's not all just about like, again, looking at information on a screen. There's other ways of like being intellectually engaging.
Depending on the topic too. I mean, some of it could be the purpose of being in this room altogether. Like if these, let's say this class is in computer science or whatever it is, they're the purpose is for them to participate in this class so they can get a good mark, that they can end up getting a degree, that they can get a better job. But this is going to sound really hippie, but what about just gathering on the lawn and talking about whatever happens? Like everybody talks about Montessori for kids, but what about Montessori for adults? You wouldn't show up to a university where they're like, hey, whatever you want to do, man, you got that check? Get that $50,000 check, because we think that's insane. But maybe that's not insane. Maybe the idea of paying for it is insane. So these kids are showing up. They're using computers everything's a tool with humans. Like they're tools to try to get to some other place, rather than what if people just showed up and just had conversations about what was happening at that moment, or you were outside and just sort of wandering around in a Montessori sense, just doing whatever felt natural. You wouldn't want to pay somebody a lot of money to do that, but that it might be the function of what some people think of mushrooms do, or DMT, where it pulls things into focus and is like, this is bullshit, we shouldn't be doing this. Maybe the tuition and all that is the bullshit that we're trying to function with a broken system.
Yeah, that's why we're all in a context that's, not to be too pessimistic, it's not that it's doomed from the beginning, but we're already in that situation of like, we're all kind of forced to be in this room right now, like regardless of, you know, to varying extents, maybe some people chose to be there and others didn't, but like whether you're at work or in a classroom or whatever, like, so it's about what we can do with those contexts. I mean, we're all kind of forced into them because of the system that we live in.
It's like we're all in some sort of collective rock band where you don't have anything in common with each other. You're there because you want to make music and you think you're going to get a record deal. And 6 months down the road, when you never really liked each other in the first place because you didn't get to know each other or you didn't have anything in common, you're stuck with each other in these rooms, and pretty soon tempers flare and stuff happens or you break up.
And then again, it's just easiest to look at your phone and then not engage. So.
Right, or the screen that you're looking at. But that happens like everywhere. Like you see tables full of people at restaurants looking at their phone or at bars. Which is, it's cliche to this point to say that because it's so obvious. Everybody knows that that's an issue. But it becomes one of the things that keeps going on. You think like, well, what are we going to do about it? We are already aware of it. So what's the next step? Is it just because the phone is like a medium that we'll end up overcoming, and it'll be Google Glass or the watch? Like, I don't think we ever like sit down and talk about like, what's the point of all this? What are we doing? Why do we need all this information? What are we going to do? Like, I could go on my laptop and find out pretty much anything. What am I going to do with that information when I get it? But you're talking about this stuff. I do feel like I don't want to be negative, because there are positives to it. And it could be just a simple thing of like, well, just don't pull out your phone. Don't pull out your laptop. It's not that big of a deal. It's like, are we doing the same thing that, say, Christians do when they complain about a boob on CBS? Like, they don't want to see a boob and they think it's inappropriate, so they want everybody not to have it. Like, when we have these discussions about technology, are we trying to dictate what's best for the entire culture when maybe we just need a break from it, or we need a vacation, or we need to relax and just find our own balance?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can, like, if you personalize it, like, I see the impact on my own personal life. So, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same for everybody. But there are instances when I'm doing it that I don't know why I'm doing it. And I think that it does have a negative impact on the, immediate relationships in my life. So, why do I keep doing it?
And why do you, like, if you have kids who are 16 and you tell them, listen, I don't believe in this cell phone culture, like, you're going to be punishing them socially to where you have to do it. You don't have a choice. You have to get them a cell phone.
Yeah. Again, so navigating the world that they're in, yeah, while still being critical of it. But, like, yeah, it's just a clusterfuck because it just keeps moving faster and getting bigger and consuming more. When we were talking about the system actually consuming us, yeah, it's like moving in. It's like we think of it like, oh, this is a personalized little machine. It's really nice. It knows so much about me. But like, yeah, it also knows everything about you. And it's also like penetrating, which I'm using very intentionally that word here, penetrating your life. Like it's invading your life in ways that like have never exactly been experienced before.
Yeah, and it's fragmenting conversations. And I mean, even just 20 years ago, people were reading books on things that they now look up online. And when you can't just, you can sort of, you know, with books, I mean, you kind of got to read a lot to find information you're looking for. You can't, you don't, and in the process of doing that, you come across new information. So if you're reading a book that you think covers this particular idea or topic and you have to read 50, 60 pages before you finally get it, well, you've already encountered like 50 pages of stuff that you might, that might have shed some light or put you in a different direction, a better direction. But when you can look up the stuff directly online, it sort of filters out or takes away all that character building or all those interactions you would have with new ideas, potentially new ideas or other thoughts. So it's a completely different game, and it's only happened in 20 years. So again, we're going back to the pessimistic here. So I don't know what the optimism is for where we're going. There's got to be something. I mean, it does. There's things that are obviously easier, but in the long run, what's the future optimist going to say?
Yeah, and what is, that just makes me think of, I don't know how related this is, but it made me think of, like, what is valuable in the moments of not knowing something? So there's that impulse for us to always look something up. Oh, I have this question, but I can have pretty much, pretty instantaneous access to who invented, what was the first podcast ever, right? You could look that up. That's a kind of question that would come up and you would look it up right away. But in the past, in other contexts, when we didn't have access so immediately to that kind of information, is there something valuable about not being able to immediately look that up and know it? And then you go through, and then you create this podcast like not knowing that? Instead of fulfilling that need immediately, like how does that change? Does it satisfy something or does it change the process of creating? So we're losing that little space in between there of not knowing anymore because we're sort of prioritizing information and knowing facts over like the imagination process itself, I think.
And in the past, if you had a question about the Egyptian pyramids, you might go up to a coffee shop that you frequent and talk to them and be like, yeah, do you have any, you know, I don't know what this is, whatever, however you could sort of massage this into the conversation, massage that into the conversation. Like, do you know anyone about that knows a lot about the pyramids or Egypt? And they might go, yeah, you know, I know this, my uncle's friends with this guy. And then maybe you end up like talking to somebody and then pretty soon you're making connections in a physical sense. You're meeting, next thing you're meeting this guy in a coffee shop a couple of days later. It's like, I just have questions about the Egyptian pyramids. Like, do you recommend any books or like what were your experiences? You've been there. Let me talk to you. Whereas now you're just sort of, you're your own expert that you're interviewing, just looking online and finding these random Wikipedia sites or whatever sites would, could be total bullshit. There's no interaction happening with another human. It's just you and the computer or other humans through the computer, but computers have become like some sort of mediary or whatever the word is.
Yeah, it's like we're trading one spontaneous element for another one. Because there is something spontaneous about, even with like dating websites or just social networking, meeting somebody online and then meeting them in person that we didn't have before. But then there's those kinds of elements where if you can't access information, then you're sort of forced to engage with people around you to get the information that you need. So even just thinking back to before having a cell phone, how complicated it could be to even like, I guess I was pretty young, like during that time period when there weren't cell phones around, but like even like trying to meet up with my friends at the mall, you have to be very particular. You have to have a plan. Where are you going to be at what time? And if anything changes, then that could throw everything off. And then you end up wandering around the mall doing something unexpected for a certain amount of time. Whereas now, like, things are allowed to be so much more fluid because we have that instantaneous sort of communication. But there's something lost there about, like, the element of spontaneity. Because, like, everything can always change because you can always sort of communicate with people.
You said the word fluid in that you, like, you could want to meet someone at 2 o'clock, that you get a text at 1:50 that they're not going to meet you till 2:30. So now you just wander. You've got this fluid motion. You're kind of, you've got 40 minutes now where you can go wherever you want. But is it fluid or is it more scripted? Like, because the spontaneity to me implies an unscripted quality. Like, if you know you're going to meet someone, or you don't know when they might show up, or if they don't, they're 10 minutes late, like, you don't know what's going to happen. That's unscripted. Whereas texts are like, I'll meet you at 2 o'clock here, be here. That's scripted. Our whole lives are becoming scripted through these things, I think. And the unscripted moments feel awkward because we're just like floating, like lost, which I think we miss. We miss that sort of idea of not having to be somewhere at all the time. Our whole lives are being worked out for us.
Yeah, like Louis C.K. has that really good bit on, I think it's Conan, where he's talking about cell phones, and he's saying, this is being a person. Just kind of like sitting here, being able to like sit here, look around, hands at your side, thinking, whatever, saying hello to somebody. That's being a person. And he's talking about in contrast to like, oh, I need to script something, I need to grab my phone.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a good point, because I think that's the thing that I think that's the basic concern that we have, is losing that human ability to connect with people or to connect with the world that we're in, rather than seeing it through a device. It's like in the 80s, they used to make fun of Asian tourists in movies taking pictures everywhere they went. And now everybody's doing that. So you're living through this device. And Louis C.K. makes another joke about how if Jesus came back, he'd have the phone, he'd be like, looking at their phone, like, oh my God, Jesus is right in front of me. Jesus is trending, like taking pictures of Jesus in front, like rather than just looking up and looking at him. Not that he exists, but I mean, the idea that you would want to like all of a sudden document it on Instagram rather than just sort of say like, hey, so it's, wow, this is happening, eh?
Yeah, the resolution on Jesus is amazing. That's what I think, that's his joke.
Thank you for listening. Art House Radio is supported by people like you who go to our website, arthouse43.com. They click on donate and then they choose to make a one-time or recurring donation. Creative projects are never free, so any support you can give would be greatly appreciated. You gotta support art. I mean, if you want to. I mean, I know most of you don't, and I'm probably guilty of that too, but we really should. We should stick together. We're together. That is the thing that bonds us. Art, right? Creative projects. That's what we're all engaging in this, and we should all be supporting each other. So send me in something that you have, and I'll support you as much as I can, financially speaking. I don't really have a ton of resources to throw everyone's way, but I got to support somebody, and so do you. So if you have somebody you want to support, support them. If you want to support this show, please do. I am your host, Troy Ramos. As always, I look forward to ending this season, this blockbuster first season of Art House Radio, next week with the unveiling of Project 100. It's going to be a great episode, I think. I'll also be playing a work of mine for two percussionists, the second part of it, which was performed in Portland, Oregon. It was premiered there last fall. All right. Anyway, let's just end this. I look forward to seeing you next week. And until then, have a great week. Until next time, friends.